much about the Diva Jazz Orchestra, but they're jazzy. They got some brass. Again, that was Three Sisters and a Cousin, and you're listening to Intravenous here on Campus Community Radio, CJSF 90.1 FM from Simon Fraser University on the unceded lands of the Kwikwetlem, the Musqueam, the Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh peoples. I'm Robin.
And I'm Pranjali.
And my phone is going crazy.
Yeah, here. And I was like, was that a custom sound?
It's technology. We're talking about gender and technology today on the show, as Pranjali and I are
always
apt
almost doing
to
that.
But it's interesting because it affects and infiltrates so much of our lives, and we don't even really think about
that. Is so true.
The ways that it does, and the things that we implement. That we kind of take for granted, right?
Absolutely.
And that these didn't always exist. And life as we understand it and life as we live it doesn't work the way that it did in the past. Just as the song break was, during the song break, Pranjali and I were talking about how... In the article we're referring to, which is the Industrial Revolution in sort of home technologies, I'll post the link up so that you can read it yourself with the audio archive of the program. But how in the time period that the author was looking at the ways technology was changing the social fabric, women had a lot of, there was a lot of domestic servitude in the time period before the technologies came into play, and that affected domestic life a lot. And so, you know, in these middle class women that she was looking at for her study, a lot of them were the managers of their household, right? They weren't actually the doers of the thing. Mm-hmm. They didn't take care of their children per se. They didn't cook the meals per se. They didn't clean the house per se. They didn't chariot their kids around to music lessons and, you know, all of the things, you know, be the soccer mom. And now when we think about our lives, right, we often don't get to manage anything in our family domestic world. We're doing everything, you know, like we're rearing our children, we're driving them to school and cheering them on at soccer, and we're cooking the meals, and we're buying the groceries, and we're nursemaiding them, and we're, you know, meeting with the teachers, and we're run ragged because there's this expectation to be the supermom or the
do-it-all mom.
The do-it-all mom, yeah. Do-it-all woman.
Yes.
And work outside the home to boot.
Yeah.
Right? And so it... There's a passage on the last page, and I'm just going to read it verbatim because it really sort of undergirds the whole notion of where we've come and what this has kind of brought us to in a way. So she says, the Industrial Revolution in the home seems to have heightened the emotional context of the work until a woman's sense of self-worth became a function of her success at arranging bits of fruit to form a clown's face in a gelatin salad. So 1950s. That pervasive social illness, which Betty Friedan in the 1960s characterized as the problem that has no name, arose not among workers who found that their labor brought no emotional satisfaction, but among workers who found that their work was invested with emotional weight far out of proportion to its own inherent value. How long, a friend of mine is fond of asking, can we continue to believe that we will have orgasms while waxing the kitchen floor? And I think that, you know, this when we talk about technology and gender and domestic technology in the context of this article anyways, and the ways that advertisers have become these ideologues, and that unsurprisingly what happens is that those beliefs and values and emotions that are attached to certain work through certain technological functions become ridden with guilt and embarrassment, then, and how we see that still reflected today in the ways that technology kind of eats away at our self-esteem. Mm-hmm. It's a different technology, but it's the same mechanism.
Mm-hmm. Also, the social structures in which it is placed,
yes,
it's the same in the way smart fridges and smart machines today construct and see how domestic life is to be, for example. Yeah, absolutely agree. And I also loved the paragraph. And it is interesting for me as a person, because that's where my current, I think, turn of research is going, is to see how social change is characterized via technology and how it's seen as, it is seen as, you know, changing and solving all the social evils, and it is not. It is just embedding or changing the roles in the ways that respect the current norms, so to say. So, yeah, it is super, super interesting in how she constructs this idea of industrial revolution at home, I mm-hmm. think. mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we can see the ways when we look at how from the past, you know, women moving from that managerial role of domesticity to, you know, having to do it all and becoming Jills of all trades and mm-hmm. getting stretched beyond their capacity, really, and also having to do things that maybe are not so flowy. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you're not such a great cook, but, you know, you've got to all of a sudden make three healthy meals a day for your family, and it's just not in you. Mm-hmm. You know, and the pressure that is, that there's a through line of getting to where Betty Friedan said, hey, wait a second, this life feels like it's not serving us in the way that it's promised. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, that was like the whole thesis of the course. It was like, how does technology change and fail to change the social structures, for example? So, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, if thinking about feminism and the feminist movement from those really grassroots, this is not what I was promised.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, how do we now extrapolate and really strive and lean into an even bigger expression of, hey, this wasn't what we were promised, and include, you know, more people, more voices, more ideas about that as technology mm-hmm. increases and further infiltrates our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I also think it's kind of different, perhaps, in how, like, domestic technologies or the kitchen technologies, there are different cases in what I'm going to make right now, which is, for example, many of these technologies were packaged in certain way, or they were talked about, or they were made to seem like they will promise some change because they were targeted at getting more funding for the scientific project. So, for example, a lot of like the Silicon Valley technologies, they package themselves, or they promise that they're going to solve the world's problem. Maybe it's in terms of like the polarization that happens on online platforms, or, you know, how they're going to have better detection of terrorism. Like, how are they going to solve all these big questions using technology? So all these promises are, the people who make, the developers, they know that their technology cannot do it. but these promises are constructed to get something, which is the funding, for example, to fund those big projects, those, you know, big technologies. And in this case, it's social change, for example. And the developers, for example, know that their technology is inherently limited in what it can do. Also in terms of like AI, for example, or AI detection tools, which is used to counterbalance the influx of AI that's happening, like ChatGPT and whatnot. So yeah, I think the promise and the packaging of what the certain technology is designed to do is created very specifically, and it's created in a certain way to serve a certain purpose, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It certainly does. Mm-hmm.
I just feel like that was something not that related to what we're talking about.
But no, it's totally related because it has it, the word in my mind is like, oh, that feels sleazy, you know, like mm-hmm. that. It just feels like I'm going to pitch something, knowing that it can't actually achieve this
yes.
goal that I'm pitching. Right,
that has happened a lot,
but I'm gonna pitch it anyways, and then I'm gonna get a heap load of money, and I'm gonna build this thing promising quote unquote social change. And the, you know, when we're referring back to this article and how the technologies of, you know, the new steam iron mm-hmm. versus the old flat iron and the washing machine and the hot water tank and, you know, indoor plumbing and you know, how households expanded into having now extra rooms in their house. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't just one room and a couple bedrooms. No, now it was like a living area and a kitchen and a bathroom and a bunch of sleeping spaces, right? So it all of a sudden it's like more space to clean, more stuff mm-hmm. to do. But the pitch and the promise was that it would alleviate and it would make life so much more easy breezy.
And better.
And you know, as we were just talking about, it's the social construct too, right? That especially in those days, because we even see it nowadays, mm-hmm. where, you know, the advertisers would have not been women, they would have been men. Not just in the majority, but in the absolute, like all of them. Mm-hmm. And they having something built by someone who doesn't use it.
Yeah. That is like the half of the problem with the
it's the problem with my refrigerator from day one is what it is.
Yes. And it's interesting how it's not limited to refrigerator anymore. And it's like, you know, you're going to be hired or you're gonna have a medical checkup depending on how these reports are checked by this technology and what it identifies as a disease or not, and if you will be hired in that position or not because your name looks foreign to the AI thing, detection, whatever. And yeah, it is super interesting. And I mean, it's sad in the way that even, for example, the data sets on which most of the prediction modeling or all the machine learning, for example, almost happens, is that the people who design those things are not the ones using it necessarily, and they are not well equipped to understand what the technology can bring with if it's put in a social setting. So yeah. Yeah, and Silicon Valley is actually full of examples of, you know, creating these apps to solve, you know, the problems in different apps to manage your sleep, manage your menstruation cycle, because then it's going to provide you with better health monitoring, and it's going to have a very, you know, positive impact on your health. Not knowing or thinking about how the cycle or how the health metrics of a black person or a brown person is different from different. Yeah, it's different for different people. So yeah, it's literally, yeah, it's not thought about when it's created. And more so the promise of technology. It's a relatively new phenomena. It has come to being mostly in the 19th century and the 20th century, of course. Because before that, like, for example, in the Archimedes times or the times of the Victorians, these people who used to invent things were supposed to be magicians or the people who used magic potions to create something. So they were seen as witches or wizards, and they were seen as like social outcasts because they were doing something that was not expected, and they were seen as anomalies in the world, and they were not as welcome. But it is interesting how those became so central to how we see societies and politics being run today, because technologies, I mean, a lot of the US funding, for example, a lot of it also goes into Silicon Valley and producing technological solutions. So it's very different to think it from the point of view of someone in the 1700s, you know? So yeah, I mean, it's super interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's even if we can imagine what the real life on the ground was, mm-hmm. for people who were living in that time. And that's one of the things that, you know, I appreciated about the article that we're referencing here by Ruth Schwartz Cohen, because she recognizes that in order to kind of figure out and determine the ways in which technology and social change kind of come together and interface. You can't just make assumptions about it based on where we are mm-hmm. on our two feet today in the world, and so she uses magazines and catalogs and things in print mm-hmm. that show photo depictions and, you know, blurbs that underpin those sort of cultural values and those cultural norms, and puts those together in a way that strings together a story that tells about a slice of life in a particular time, right? And so that I think is important because we can't just make assumptions about how, you know, oh, the automobile was invented and that was a good thing and now we can travel everywhere and because of that we can go to the moon and, you know, but it's more complicated than that.
Exactly, yeah. It's interesting how, like, even the idea of, like, progress and modernity, it's really constructed as a linear thing that you study in a school and then you finish school, then you get a job, and then you can earn as much money you want, and then you can, you know, jump through the social classes and get wherever you want to. But are you really sure how that happens? So yeah, it's not a linear idea of progress with technology, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it affects different people in mm-hmm. different ways, as we were able to see in this article, right? Like there were some people, some women who were negatively affected by the advent of technology, and some women who were, you know, kind of unaffected perhaps mm-hmm. or affected in completely different ways, right? And so that is also not trying to find that sort of equitable lens, you know, where you can see how it affects everybody across the spectrum of what the social fabric is of course one of the challenging things about research in general, because we all have such a different experience and our input and output is so unique, but nevertheless quite an interesting kind of thought experiment for this morning on Intravenous. Just looking at the time, do you have anything you want to sort of finalize on or wrap
yeah.
up?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know, I just feel like it's really important to have a critical lens, for example, when talking about new technologies. That's the one sentence that I'm going to stick to. Because what is new, it's not necessarily good. And what is a technology is necessarily not going to solve our problems. So, yeah. I will leave it to that because I can definitely talk about it more, but I don't want to, like, go over the time. So thank you so much, Robin, for having me. And it's so much fun to talk about things with you.
Yeah, thanks. That you always bring these ideas that really get my gray matter going. So I appreciate that, and hope that in listening land you're stimulated by some of these ideas that we've brought to the table as well. It is the merry festive time in the world. The station is and will be closed for the week between Christmas and New Year's. And so from us to you, we wish you a very safe and happy holiday. I'm off to Calgary tomorrow to spend time with my small family. And I just hope it's not as cold as the last time I was there when it was minus 29 and the wind was brutal. So if you could just put a little prayer on for me, that would be amazing because I'm all West Coast soft now. my prairie girl tolerance has dwindled.
But no, awesome. And yeah, I hope we can keep similar conversations going in the new year. And yeah, I'm excited to see people back on campus because it's really empty right now. So yeah.
All right, stay tuned for Democracy Now! It's coming up in just 30 seconds or so. Thanks for listening.